Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
On our show today, Adam, we will be talking with Dr. Megan Bear Merritt, Associate Professor of Pediatrics and Medical Director of Child Witness to Violence Program at Boston Medical Center, about domestic violence in children.
Yeah, I think this question of domestic violence and intimate partner violence and the effects then on the children who witness it are profound. I'm really looking forward to this conversation, Christy. But first, we're going to have a conversation about some interesting research, including this research about codeine being banned by the Food and Drug Administration and what can parents do after their children have common surgeries.
About this notion of an apple a day keeps the doctor away, and is that true?
About research that looks at obesity and decline in kidney function. Are we looking at a new risk factor for kidney disease?
And finally, is there a link between chewing gum and headaches and migraine headaches in teenagers? So let's start with codeine and acupuncture for pain after kids get their tonsils out.
Well, we know, Christy, that the Food and Drug Administration recently banned the use of codeine last year after children have had tonsillectomy surgery, and because of the real risk of depressing the breathing and the side effects. And so the question is, what can children after having a tonsillectomy, which is one of the most common surgeries, do for pain?
And you can certainly give them Tylenol or acetaminophen or ibuprofen. But there was a study that we're talking about now that looked at 31 patients that were children ages 2 to 17 years to see if acupuncture, which is known to have some benefits for pain, could make a difference in these children.
This was published in the International Journal of Pediatric Otolaryngology, a very difficult word to say, but ENT, ear, nose, and throat. And these children and teens received acupuncture after the tonsillectomy, and they showed they and or their parents that their pain level decreased significantly after about 15 minutes of acupuncture. And this lasted for about 2.5 days. I found this pretty remarkable.
It is remarkable. I mean, it's difficult to say for sure because the people who received acupuncture obviously knew they were receiving it. So you couldn't do one of those fancy double-blinded control trials that we like to talk about, Adam. But, you know, there's very little by way of side effect and harm. And so if it makes a difference, I think it's worth a try. What do you think?
I think it could be. I'd like to see more research here. I think they didn't compare active acupuncture, which is what we call sham acupuncture. Mm-hmm. And this was maybe done by a researcher who has a strong interest in this outcome, not necessarily through monetary, but in belief. So I think that you're right, Christy. There's probably not much harm, particularly compared to some of the alternatives, but more to be done. What's our very next research that matters?
Okay. So does an apple a day keep the doctor away?
Well, I can tell you, Christy, that there are certain people in my family, you'll never get their names out of me, but my daughter and my wife love apples.
And so how much do they go to the doctor?
Well, I don't know, but they eat them every day. And
they're
actually
healthy.
I had apples for lunch today, which I don't
good
usually have,
you.
But that apple just looked very good. And the question is, if I were to have an apple a day for the next 20 years compared to perhaps taking a cholesterol drug, a statin, to lower my cholesterol, would I have better outcomes with one or the other? And I'm not sure if this is a fair question, but it's the one that they did the research on.
Yeah. So this was published in the journal BMJ, or British Medical Journal, a study that was done in the United Kingdom, where they really like modeled out the benefits from prescribing an apple a day to all adults over age 50 compared with giving one of these statin drugs to everyone over age 50 to see, really, would it be about the same or a big difference?
And they assume that only 70% of the people taking the drug or taking the apple would do as they're told, and that people taking the apples didn't actually gain overall calories. And they basically calculated that giving the statin to about 17 million more people in England would reduce deaths by almost 10,000, while offering an apple to 70% of the total United Kingdom population aged over 50 years would do about 9,000 preventive deaths, but the statins had more side effects. So they basically said an apple a day could be about as effective as a statin. I don't know about this. This is all about calculated mathematic models, but it did get us very interested about apples.
It did. I mean, and I think it's good to point out that for you in particular, specifically if you have really high cholesterol, or if you've had a heart attack or some other reasons, well, this may not apply to you. This is really about a population level across the country. But I mean, an apple is a whole lot cheaper and has a whole lot less side effects than a statin. What'd you learn about apples?
Well, I learned that apples have these phytonutrients.
Phytonutrients. It sounds fun to say.
Well, they have these chemicals, the natural chemicals in them that help prevent the blood sugar from going up a whole lot. So that actually can help prevent some of the blood sugar problems for some people or developing them. They're a great source of dietary fiber. And then finally, that they may have some beneficial effect on the bacteria in our guts and help prevent some of these infections. And so, you know, they're high in fiber, they're high in vitamin C, and they're low in calories. That sounds like a pretty good food to me.
Yeah, and maybe if you eat more apples, then you won't fill up with other junk food. So maybe there's also, you know, another effect on health.
I think my daughter and my wife are going to be competing with me for apples.
Well, let's do our next research that matters, which is about a link between your weight and your kidney function.
This particular article that was in the American Journal of Kidney Diseases looked at 10 years of data from a long-term study that looked at the health of thousands of African-American and white young adults since 1985. And in this particular study, almost 3,000 people from this particular study, they looked at their body mass index and whether or not they were normal weight, overweight, obese, or very obese, and how that related to their kidney function over time.
Yeah, I mean, they started out all around 35 years of age with normal kidney function, and they followed them, like you said, for a long time. And what they found was that even after they accounted for people who had diabetes or high blood pressures or inflammatory problems that we know are linked to kidney disease, this body mass index, or a marker of your obesity, was still a predictor for losing or having problems with your kidney function.
And they used a very sensitive test, which is even more sensitive than what doctors typically use, and they could pick this up even earlier. And the decline in the kidney function was greater and more rapid in those that were heavier. This does not show causality, but it is a very significant, I think, link in a puzzle. And it perhaps for lots of doctors and patients who are wondering, why is this patient's kidneys seem to be a little bit less functioning than someone else's? Let's look at the weight.
I mean, it's yet another thing that links obesity to poor health outcomes. So if you are overweight out there, now is a great time. It's, you know, we're into a new year. It's a great time to talk with your doctor and really make a plan to work on it.
Our very last research that matters, Christy, real quickly, is from the journal Pediatric Neurology. And it's about a study of 30 patients who had migraine headaches in teenagers. And what happened if they stopped chewing gum that a lot of them did? And what did they find?
What they found is that of 30 patients, 26 of them reported significant improvement in their headaches. 19 of them had complete headache resolution. Now, of course, this is not a trial done where half of them stopped and half of them continued on and all of that. They recommended it to everyone. And you knew if you stopped chewing gum. So it's not, you know, one of, by our standards, the best study in the world. But
it's a simple intervention.
It is a simple thing.
Well, that'll conclude the research that matters. We've had a good chance to talk about maybe stopping chewing gum if you've got headaches in adults or children.
To talk about a link between obesity and early decline in your kidney function.
About the health benefits of an apple, and maybe it helps keep you out of the doctor.
And about a study finding there could be benefit for acupuncture after getting your tonsils out to help treat pain.
Well, we're going to take a short break, but when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Megan Baer-Merritt about domestic violence in children. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're going to be talking with Dr. Megan Bear Merritt, Associate Professor of Pediatrics and Medical Director of Child Witness to Violence Program at Boston Medical Center, about her work on domestic violence and children who witness it.
Welcome to the show, Dr. Bear Merritt.
Thank you so much for having me here.
We're glad to have you. You know, tell us a little bit about your background and what led you to become so passionate about intimate partner violence and domestic violence as something that you really wanted to make a difference in.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So I am a pediatrician, although now I spend the majority of my time doing research and research in the field of intimate partner violence and its impact on children. But I think the interest goes back actually to my pediatric residency when I was doing my primary care clinics. And what I found was that the things that were going on in patients' lives, and particularly women's stories about the violence that they were experiencing, had profound effect on their children's health. And I watched, and women really wanted to share their stories, and they wanted to talk about kind of what they thought the impact was on their children. And so at the time, I sort of learned about the field of general academic pediatrics, and I realized that this was something that I could begin to look at and study more.
Well, why do you think the public health problem of intimate partner violence isn't really emphasized? I mean, in your article, you highlight that 15 million children in the United States live in families in which this type of violence occurs, and 7 million of them have witnessed this. Is this something that we don't want to talk about?
Yeah, so, Adam, I think that's a really good question. And, I think that people don't realize how common it is. And so when I give talks to larger audiences, I ask physicians how many people have taken care of a child with asthma in the past month, and almost everybody raises their hand. And we know that some of the most recent statistics about prevalence of childhood asthma in the U.S. are that about 7 million children have asthma. So we know that twice that number of children are living in homes where there's intimate partner violence. I think, though, as a field, we have not been as successful in mounting a public health campaign as, say, the anti-smoking public health campaigns or the obesity campaigns. And I think that this is in part because there is still people sort of want to believe that this is not a problem that affects them or their family, and that, sort of this is something that happens to somebody else. But I think that is part of the reason why it's so important to keep talking about this, because we know that this is not a problem that just affects kind of one group of people. It is cross-cutting for women of all socioeconomic statuses, all races and ethnicities.
Well, do you think that doctors have a little bit of part of this blame? Because we could see this in the emergency room. We can see it in your pediatric practices. We see it in family medicine practices, the urology practice. It would be in every practice, but we maybe don't make that linkage. Do we have part of the blame?
Yeah, I think we have a lot of blame in not thinking about screening and intervening. Actually, I have 2 children, and when I was taking my daughter for her first pediatric visits, I began talking with a pediatrician, and she was asking a little bit about the work that I did, and this was a practice that served predominantly kind of higher SES patients. And I told her that I did research related to intimate partner violence and its impact on patients, and she looked at me. This was the first time I had met her, and she said, "Well, we don't have any of that in our practice."
Aww.
And I thought, well, you have it. You're just not asking, and you're not looking for it. And so I think As physicians, we know that we're not well trained to do it. And I think people are worried about how to ask the question and how to respond. On the flip side, you know, as physicians, we ask about sensitive issues all the time. And we know that many patients, you know, this trauma really affects their health. And so until we begin to really talk about it, it's hard to really sort of holistically help our patients and their children.
So you talk about in your article children who can be directly and indirectly exposed to intimate partner violence. And you also use the term silent victims with respect to children. Paint us a picture. Give us a scenario or, a situation with a family and the dynamics and violence in the home and how that might affect children as silent victims.
I think many people view intimate partner violence as an adult problem, that this is something that happens between two adults in a romantic relationship. But we know that it's really sort of anything but that. And I think actually the epidemiology is interesting in that we know that risk of intimate partner violence goes way up for families where there's a child less than 5 years of age. So if you look at homes where there are no kids or homes that are only have older kids, they have less of a risk of having intimate partner violence going on. So intimate partner violence is common, particularly in these families with young children. We would like to think that when there's a violent disagreement, all families have these huge mansions and it only happens at 3 a.m, way far away from the kids. But that's obviously not the reality for families. And so what happens is that when there is a violent disagreement, families tell us that most commonly the kids are either right there or overhearing the violent altercation from another room. And what happens for those kids is that what would happen to any of us if we were in that situation when you're watching your kind of primary caregivers do something really scary? It elicits a trauma, a fight or flight reaction. So your heart rate goes up, your blood pressure goes up, you release cortisol, which is, we know, adaptive in the short term. But when children mount that fight or flight fear response over and over again, it has significant impact, negative impact on their health.
And is this true with violence, like physical violence, where there's, where someone's hitting someone else or they're hitting each other? Or is this also true with, violent, angry disagreements, belittling, threatening?
It seems to be true for both. So, when that child is there and watching their parents do something that's very scary for them and, they're sort of not sure what's going to happen next, their bodies do sort of what we all learned, is what happens, what we're programmed to do if we see a bear in the woods. We want to leave quickly. And so it can be both, verbal abuse and physical abuse that can trigger these reactions in children.
Well, I know we're going to need to take a short break. When we come back, maybe you can help us walk through what are the physical and emotional and social real problems, and then what can we do about it to confront this, and maybe the research that's securing it. We're going to take a short break. When we return, we'll continue talking with our guest, Dr. Megan Bear Merritt, Associate Professor of Pediatrics and Medical Director of Child Witness to Violence Program at Boston Medical Center, about domestic violence in children. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on 97.9 FM WCHL.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Megan Bear Merritt, Associate Professor of Pediatrics and Medical Director of Child Witness to Violence Program at Boston Medical Center, about domestic violence in children. And Dr. Bear Merritt, before the break, you were sharing with us a little bit about just damages and health effects of children being exposed to intimate partner violence. And we were hoping we could get into some of those health effects. I'm thinking of a family that I know where the husband has a substance abuse problem with alcohol and just gets really mean and angry at night. And sometimes that leads to violence, both verbal and occasionally physical. But the children, the young children being exposed to this, and that type of situation where that's a repetitive thing through their childhood, what kinds of things have you learned could be health effects on the children witnessing that?
Yeah, no, Christy, I think that's a great question. And, you know, I think we're learning more and more every day. I think we know the most about children's social and emotional health. And, you know, I think this makes sense for a lot of reasons. It makes sense because, you know, it's hard to parent. In general, it's hard to parent, but it's really hard to parent in a home where there's violence and kids can have problems with attachment relationships. Kids also, when they're in a home like the one you're describing, what they see is that when you have a conflict, you work it out by, you know, hitting somebody or yelling at somebody. And so these kids, when they go into preschool, when they go into elementary school, tend to have issues both with what we call externalizing behaviors, so things like aggressiveness with peers, and also internalizing behaviors like depression and anxiety. I think we are learning a lot more both about the impact on children's developing brains and then also the impact on their physical health. So with regard to their developing brains, you know, I think most people think, well, you know, these kind of young kids, birth to three, they don't remember what happened. And so, you know, it's probably fine for them. And if anything, we are learning that the truth is actually the opposite. Because if you think about kind of all of the things kids learn from the time they're born to the time they're three, they learn to walk, they learn to talk. Their brains are developing tremendously rapidly. And so when they're exposed to traumatic stress, even if they're not forming a conscious memory, they're mounting that fight or flight response. And that fight or flight response actually has or can lead to changes in their brain development that may lead to some of these emotional health problems.
So
we're also learning much more about the physical health. And similarly, just as, you know, that repeated activation of the stress response system can affect brain development, it can affect pathways like inflammation. So there have actually been at least four studies out there, including some of our work that have looked at development of asthma in kids who are in homes with intimate partner violence. And it seems that being in these homes actually increases these children's risk of developing asthma.
Hmm. So if we move this from the field of the statistics, which are overwhelming and sobering, and kind of the basic science that you're describing, which really helps us understand the mechanisms, what do we do about it? Because it seems that, I mean, dealing with intimate partner violence as a family doctor is in and of itself a very difficult and sometimes overwhelming problem. Now we add into it the physical, emotional, social problems of the child. Can we intervene, and does it make a difference?
Yeah, you know, I think it's an important question, and one in the research world we're still learning about. But what we do know is, one, I think in the medical field we need to increasingly reach out and partner with our community organizations. And so most communities have a domestic violence program, and I think a lot of people assume that that program is kind of just shelter, which a lot of women don't want to go to often for very good reasons. But most domestic violence programs actually also offer mental health services for women, sometimes for children. And they also can offer legal advocacy or just kind of general domestic violence support and advocacy. So I think the first thing is, as physicians, when we see patients, offering them kind of a menu of options, offering the ability to call the local domestic violence program from our phones, because their phones can be tracked. I think seeing women and their children back again, I think connecting children when it's safe to their own mental health resources. And then I think the last thing that's really important that we're learning also from the science, but has really important translation to kind of what we do in medicine and in public health, is we're learning that kids, this traumatic stress and this impact on their health can really be buffered when there's a very strong caregiver-child relationship. And so we can't always, and it takes a long time to, you know, sort of help women through, you know, deciding what's safest for them. But at the same time, giving them resources to help support them as a parent can be really powerful.
So some of these women are faced with a decision, especially, I mean, when it's not outright life-threatening, if there's not so much physical violence, but more verbal and other partner violence, you know, facing looking at, okay, I have young children. If I leave, what kind of life will I have financially in a new home and a new school and a new whatever for the children versus trying to stick it out and shield them from that? And I found that to be something moms are very concerned about, of making those decisions without, you know, clarity of which is best for the child. How do you guide families in that?
You know, I think for each individual family, the answer is different. I think just recognizing actually that these are tremendously difficult choices. I think we don't help women when we say the only answer is that you have to leave, because it is so incredibly complex in terms of thinking about safety and finances. And, you know, many children actually want their fathers there. And so I think making sure that it's an open conversation and thinking about kind of the needs of that individual family, which also change over time. And then again, thinking about ways that the mother can really spend some quality time and talking about bonding with her children. We know that when there's that kind of buffering of stress, it can be really protective for the children.
We're talking with Dr. Megan Baer-Merritt, Associate Professor of Pediatrics at Boston Medical Center. And Dr. Baer-Merritt, let me ask you a question that I'm not sure I even know the answer on, but our patients, sometimes the women and even the men, if they're being abused by a partner, but the child itself is not being abused, and we find out perhaps while we're with the child that this is occurring, what do we do with that information? Because if the child is actually not being physically abused, but yet your research is now showing that they're having adverse effects, wouldn't we be required to report that? What do we do with that ethical situation?
That is a really, really important question, and one actually now that the federal government is increasingly getting behind into that partner violence screening that they're grappling with as well. And the answer is complicated. So in all 50 states, medical professionals are mandated reporters of child abuse and neglect. That said, each state statutes are somewhat different when it comes to sort of what are those definitions and how inclusive are they. There are a handful of states where actually on the books it says that if you are a medical provider and you learn that a child has been exposed to domestic violence, you must report to Child Protective Services. End of story. There are another group of states who don't say that quite as explicitly, but in case law, they've interpreted childhood exposure to intimate partner violence, even if there's sort of no other forms of direct abuse, they've interpreted that as falling under childhood emotional abuse.
So for our listeners who are intrigued by this conversation of a really complex topic, and we do appreciate you breaking it down for us, but where would be some trustworthy websites or references that our listeners could, or we could potentially put on our blog? Do you have a reference handy?
Yeah, and so the one that I think is most comprehensive is the Futures Without Violence website.
Futures Without Violence.
Yep. So they have wonderful resources related to childhood exposure and then also healthcare screening, as actually does the Center for Disease Control and Prevention.
Okay.
And then lastly, for providers who are interested in learning more about screening and resources for their patients, there is a website called LEAPSF, so LEAPSF.org. Created by folks out in San Francisco, and it has wonderful patient-related resources and information for providers.
Well, we'll put both of these on our website, and we want to thank you very much for talking with your health listeners today about an important topic to families across the United States.
Thank you so much for having me.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health continues now.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the house call segment of our show, Adam and I will spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and your concerns.
If you have issues or concerns or stories you'd like Christy or I to address on an upcoming show, send them to us at yourhealth@unc.edu. And now we'd like to ask our executive producer, Erica Lloyd, to read us our very first house call today.
9 months ago, my husband had radiation for throat cancer. His cancer responded well to the treatment, and we were told on our last appointment that he appears to be in remission. He experienced a few side effects, including hair loss, decreased muscle size, and decreased blood counts. Since completing chemotherapy, these symptoms have improved, but his depression is at an all-time high. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, thank you for sharing the story, and our heart certainly goes out to you and your husband for going through radiation for throat cancer, and it's great news that he's in remission. Depression, unfortunately, is very common in patients who have defeated cancer, for patients who have chronic health problems. It's especially common in the scenario that you describe.
And the concerns about the cancer itself, the concerns about the treatment, the physical effects, the social effects, psychological effects, your relationship, these are all issues that are complex. And sometimes as doctors, perhaps we don't ask as much as we should about them, either perhaps at the specialist level or even at the primary care level. So thank you for opening up the conversation to have. And I think this is where we start. We have the conversation, either your husband coming and talking to the doctor, you're going with your husband a lot of times to help have that conversation and kind of force your doctor to have the conversation with you.
And the good news is that a lot of people can have some relief of those depression symptoms through counseling, through medications, sometimes both. But there is hope. And there are treatments out there that can really make a difference. So we want you to pursue those things for him.
Increasingly, survivorship, a nice word we now use medically to talk about surviving cancer, mm-hmm. really means that the same things that happen to people who don't have cancer, depression, happen maybe even more severe as people with cancer. So thank you for sharing that question. And we look forward to hopefully a continued recovery by your husband. Erica, what's our very next house call?
I was recently diagnosed with psoriasis by my dermatologist. She prescribed me a topical cream to ease my discomfort, but I'm really actually feeling more irritation with the topical cream than without it. Before it was just an itchy sensation, but now when I apply the cream, my skin begins to burn. I'm a 34-year-old woman who would prefer to use herbal remedies instead. Could you suggest any?
Tough situation here, and thank you for sharing the question. And I guess the first thing I would want to know is, what happened? What was the product that the dermatologist prescribed you? And you talk with the dermatologist so you can find out, was it the medicine they gave you that caused the reaction, or perhaps the vehicle of the medicine? Was it in like an alcohol base or in some sort of other reason why you had that reaction?
And also, did you have some little wounds or from scratching or other little abrasions there on your skin that might have made that more painful to put the steroid cream on? Usually, we encourage people to use those steroid creams to sort of knock it back, to get it under control. It doesn't cure it, but it can sort of get it to a level that then using herbal lotions or emollient creams, aloe lotions, things that can really keep the moisture in the skin can help it from to stay sort of knocked back or not flared up.
A lot of patients, dermatologists and primary care physicians, will talk about tar-based lotions. Some people feel those are herbal. They are derived from tar, and those can help take off a lot of those scales. They don't smell real good, they're really part of it. Sunlight itself is actually in a very small quantity for these areas. And then there are some other particular herbal medications that a lot of times people use, and we can talk about some of them. I don't know if you've heard of any of them, Christy, at all. Some people talk about, you mentioned aloe, but people talk about apple cider vinegar, Dead Sea salts, which
some
have
people
this.
People exfoliate. There are all kinds of different products you could
oatmeal
get.
Oatmeal and oats, which again are soothing and moisturizing. Some people use tea tree oil. But again, there's very little evidence of its effectiveness there. And certainly if you have open wounds, some of these things could also be equally irritating.
Mm-hmm. We would encourage you to perhaps try some of those things, but go back to your doctor and let her know about the irritation that you had. And maybe you can come up with a plan that blends those two treatment routes. Let's take our very next house call question. Erica?
I'm a 60-year-old male who was diagnosed with diabetes and hypertension. I'm also really overweight. My energy level is really low, and I'm wondering if testosterone would help. What do you think?
I think that we have some opinions on this one. I don't know if we're going to agree on this opinion, but we think that you've got some things that definitely need to be improved on.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes just from being very overweight or from having diabetes and high blood pressure that may not yet be under control since they were just newly diagnosed, sometimes those things themselves can be the reason why you're feeling low energy. Whether testosterone would help, I would want to know, well, what is your testosterone? Is it low or is it not? You wouldn't want to just like start some testosterone if you didn't have a reason.
And in addition, testosterone treatment in and of itself could raise your blood pressure. So this is not necessarily an entirely benign a treatment. And increasingly, there's not a lot of evidence that testosterone treatment for people who aren't, just as you said, Christy, with low testosterone is really beneficial. And finally, I'd want to know, are you possibly depressed? Now, I'm not saying you are depressed, but I think having a conversation with your physician or mental health therapist just to make sure that that's not part of this process, because your fatigue won't get better with testosterone, just if you're depressed.
Yeah, we would encourage you to go back to talk to your doctor, really focus on getting that diabetes and high blood pressure and weight under control, and then take the next steps for your energy level.
What's our very last house call, Erica?
My mother is a Burmese patient. When I go with her to the doctor, I always question if I should have an interpreter or if I'm a suitable translator for her. What are your thoughts?
That is tricky.
And yeah, thank you for going to the doctor with your mother. But I would strongly encourage you to ask for a translator. You are a good daughter, but you're not a substitute for a medical translator. And also, might put you in an uncomfortable position for the doctor to be asking some questions that you don't really want to translate exactly as the doctor said.
Well, and it also could put your mom in a funny position if maybe she didn't want to be fully honest or talk about certain things with you as the translator. So it adds another dynamic that could impact her health care. So I agree with you, Adam, that unless she feels strongly that you're the only one, that using a medical translator will facilitate the best care for her.
You'll have to probably, in many if not most practices, actually call ahead and arrange that. And in some practices, that may not be available, in which case you probably should have an open conversation with the doctor about some limitations and to really ensure that you're comfortable and that your mother gets the best care. But again, thank you so much for your question and really all of our house call questions today. And that'll conclude Your Health segment today. We want to thank you all and all of our listeners for all of your questions.
Yeah, we want you to share your questions and write us your stories by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org, follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, and our health app.
We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Megan Bear Merritt. We hope you join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
We'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health at WCHL's website, chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, Chapel Hill Carborough's news, talk, and Tar Heel station.
Check out our comprehensive community calendar, photo galleries, and all of our news stories and more from 97.9 FM WCHL on chapelboro.com.